took all of those agencies that overlapped in different authorities, and we called the Coast Guard. Commission does the Coast Guard. And then, obviously, the rest is history.
Celebrating the 225th birthday of the U.S. Coast Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, concern over dead birds washing up on beaches in Homer.
What we're seeing more precisely is that birds seem to be starving, but something might be happening before that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Today is the 225th birthday of the United States Coast Guard. The new commanding officer of Air Station Kodiak, Captain Mark Morin, says he started in his current position in June, but his time as a pilot in the Coast Guard first brought him to Kodiak in the mid-1990s. Morin says the Coast Guard has been fighting the wind and the rain on Kodiak Island since the late 1940s.
This was a Navy station built, commissioned in 1941. And then in 1947, we had a Coast Guard detachment of PBY Catalina aircraft, which were the kind of aircraft that had a boat-type bottom that would land on the water and would conduct search and rescue out here in this region. And then in 1972, it officially was turned over, the base was turned over to the U.S. Coast Guard.
He said the Coast Guard has been around since the late 18th century, but not as one organization.
So 1790 was the birth of the Coast Guard, okay? And we weren't called the Coast Guard back then. We were called the Revenue Cutoff Service, Lighthouse Service, Bureau of Navigation, Steamboat Service, and then Life Saving Service. So there was like five agencies back then.
Warren says the present-day Coast Guard was established in 1915. The Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge is receiving multiple reports indicating a significant increase in dead and dying birds found on beaches in the Homer area over the last 2 weeks. The reports are coming from beach walkers and local citizen scientists dedicated to surveying seabird populations. Leslie Slater is the Gulf of Alaska unit biologist for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. She says the number of birds reported is in the dozens.
So it's hard to give a real exact number of the normal number, but I would say on a given stretch of beach, we normally don't find, more than one within a couple mile stretch.
Slater says there are a lot of potential reasons for the increase in fatalities, but the prevailing cause is likely tied to the birds' food sources.
What we're seeing more precisely is that birds seem to be starving, but something might be happening before that. We might be having a PSP outbreak, or another situation is called domoic acid, where these biotoxins can build up through the food chain and ultimately cause the death of these birds.
The deaths don't seem to be isolated to Homer's beaches. There are reports of similar deaths down the Alaska Peninsula and the eastern edge of the Aleutians. Slater says it's possible they could be related to dead whales found near Kodiak. To narrow down causes of death, Slater says the refuge will send the carcasses of Homer's birds to the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin.
And there they have a whole team of expert epidemiologists and other wildlife disease specialists who will be able to examine them and probably come up with a real good conclusion.
Slater expects the center to receive the carcasses by the end of this week and believes there could be a reply within 2 weeks. She asks that people continue to call in if they spot dead birds with the species name and location, but she warns the public not to touch dead birds because they could be carrying diseases. 20-year-old Samuel Atchak was arraigned in Bethel Superior Court this morning. He's charged in the murder of Roxanne Smart last August. The arraignment follows an indictment by a grand jury. A public defender today entered not guilty pleas. Atchak was arrested in July after a long wait for results from a crime lab. According to court documents, he admitted to investigators that he killed Smart in August of 2014. His case will be back in court October 1st for an omnibus hearing. 19-year-old Roxanne Smart was found dead outside in the community of Chivek after being sexually assaulted. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a protest on the anniversary of a Canadian mine failure.
We just want to make everybody aware, especially here in Wrangell, at the mouth of the river, aware that we are here and we're not going to stand for it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Yesterday, the U.S. Senate considered legislation that would have defunded Planned Parenthood. Both Alaska senators voted to advance the bill, but it failed on a procedural motion, so the Senate has gone on to other issues. Meanwhile, though, reaction to Senator Lisa Murkowski's yes vote in favor of moving the anti-Planned Parenthood bill is still ricocheting around Alaska and social media. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Alaskans who support abortion rights feel burned, while conservatives aren't giving Murkowski much credit.
Lisa Jameson is a licensed clinical social worker in Anchorage and a supporter of Planned Parenthood. She feels strongly enough about the issue that she wrote Murkowski's office and asked her to vote against defunding the organization. Jameson says she used to think of Murkowski as overtly pro-choice, and to say she feels disappointed now is an understatement.
That's really very upsetting to me. I feel like I don't know how to say it. I feel like she's sold her soul. I just don't think that she's being true to the values that she's always consistently espoused over the years.
The Senate vote this week was just procedural, and Murkowski says she believes Planned Parenthood does important work. But she was appalled by secret videotapes showing officials in the organization talking about harvesting fetal tissue for research. Murkowski says she voted to take up the defunding bill because she wanted to amend it to call for an investigation.
Let's make clear for the record what it is that is actually happening here. Because if there has been nothing unlawful, then do we really want to jeopardize the access to care that some 21,000 people in Alaska have access to? No, I don't want to.
Murkowski says if a Planned Parenthood affiliate is found to have broken the law, she wants to see federal funding to that branch cut off. You could call her solution a middle road. But abortion rights supporters are taking to Facebook and Twitter to say Murkowski is running to the right, that she's spinning, that she lacks the courage of her convictions. Rocky Plotnick, a yoga teacher and health educator in Anchorage, says Murkowski's vote speaks volumes.
I always considered her to be a moderate Republican, and she tended to be supportive of women and pro-choice issues. So she's moved to the right, and I think that it's a huge disappointment.
Plotnick, who chairs a committee of the Alaska Democratic Party, says Murkowski's explanation and reasons don't sway her.
Because I know that she's looking at a reelection bid in the next year, and I know that she wants to make more conservative voters in Alaska happy.
Murkowski has voted for abortion rights in the U.S. Senate and before that in the Alaska legislature. But what's consistent about her voting history on abortion is that she has repeatedly disappointed both sides. Her annual scorecard with abortion rights groups has swung wildly over the years, from 80% to zero and back up again. On the anti-abortion side, National Right to Life's website says since 2003, Murkowski has voted with them more often than not. Republican Judy Elledge organized an anti-Planned Parenthood demonstration in Anchorage after the videos emerged. She says she wishes Murkowski's support for the defunding bill was as strong as Senator Dan Sullivan's. He's a co-sponsor. Ellidge says she respects Murkowski's vote on the procedural motion.
But I also know that she is very pro-choice.
Ellidge says it's too early to say whether she'd support Murkowski's reelection, but she says the senator's vote to advance the bill won't affect her decision.
She and I differ greatly on social issues, and so therefore, I guess it would depend on who it was against.
Before the Senate vote, Alaska Family Action President Jim Minnery urged his supporters to contact Murkowski and tell her to vote yes. He sent one headline, "Urgent, please contact Murkowski now, vote happening within an hour." Minnery's not giving kudos to Murkowski now because he says the vote was just procedural, in essence, a vote to have a vote on the bill.
And that's what Lisa Murkowski did, and there's not really much to applaud, to be honest, because that's why they go to the U.S. Senate, is to vote.
The federal government pays Planned Parenthood $500,000 a year for non-abortion services. For now, the effort to defund the organization is off the Senate agenda, but it's likely to return in the fall in a fight over government spending bills. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The two special sessions held as lawmakers struggled to agree on a state budget cost more than $886,000. Legislative Affairs Agency Finance Manager Jessica Gary expects the vast majority of claims have been submitted, although some still could come in. The figure doesn't include the cost of extending the regular session by 8 days. Gary says her agency only has the daily allowance cost for lawmakers for that period, about $105,000. Legislators went into overtime after failing to reach a budget deal. The special session called for Juno by the governor featured an 11-day break in floor sessions amid the stalemate, during which lawmakers scattered and hearings were held in Anchorage. Lawmakers then called their own special session for Anchorage, citing capital renovation work. It lasted 3 weeks. An artist is creating life-size sculptures of Alaskans to tell the story of those who struggle with mental health. Sarah Davies traveled to one of the state's most vulnerable regions recently for a project called 100 Stone. KYUK's Daisha Eaton profiles her attempt to highlight the toll that depression takes and what people can do to help those in need.
Sarah Davies is dressed in plaster-covered overalls and slathering the white gluey substance on the 6'4" frame of Chuck Herman in the art room at the Kuskokwim campus of UAF in Bethel.
First it felt like they were just putting like a big heavy wet blanket on me, and then it started getting more and more constricting, so I feel pretty immobile at the moment.
That's a lot like what Davies says mental illness can feel like. She knows, as she struggled with mental health herself, including depression, anxiety, PTSD, and suicidal thoughts.
What that means is people who experience chronic illness, mental illness, which is a huge umbrella, grief, persistent grief, suicide losses, addiction and substance abuse, trauma. Those are emotional burdens that may be like the weight of a bull on our shoulders, which is what the unit of weight 100 Stone represents.
Davies is leading the project called 100 Stone. This is the very first casting session off the road system in Alaska. It's a public art installation of 100 stories of personal struggles with mental health. Alaskans suffer at rates well beyond the national average in several mental health categories. Davies wrapped Herman in plastic, burlap, and plaster. It's kind of like a cast for a broken arm or leg, but for the whole body. Davies has already completed about 80 or so body castings on the road system. The aim of the project, she says, is to transform cultural attitudes and approaches toward those who struggle with mental health.
Suicide awareness is one of the effects of what we're doing. What this is truly doing is speaking a truth that we are here and we are suffering and we are hiding in plain sight. And it is an isolating experience. And it is within that isolation that we find ourselves most at risk for things like suicide.
The YK Delta region has high suicide rates, especially among Native youth. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation confirms 9 suicides in the region this year, 4 of them in Bethel. Herman, who works with youth as a high school career counselor in Bethel and is a member of the Bethel City Council, says he hopes to put the issue out front.
Anything that raises awareness of mental health issues is obviously an important thing, especially, I mean, in the U.S. in general and then this community with all the issues we've had and continue to have with around mental health.
Davies plans to display all of the life-sized human forms from across the state on the Anchorage mudflats in December. They'll be positioned walking into the water. And like the uncertainty of mental illness, the dramatic tides of Cook Inlet will wash some away.
We expect some will be lost, and that matches our experience in the world. We expect some will remain, and some will be recoverable, but perhaps unrecognizable.
Davies says the scene will deliver a critical message of hope to Alaskans.
The important truth there is that isolation and shame is what puts us at greatest risk. And when we can see each other in that special way, that part that we try to hide, that's where we find the light.
Davies cast 6 bodies in Bethel to add to the project. She has about 20 or so more castings to do in other bush communities to reach her goal of 100. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Three men caught on videotape are suspected of breaking into the construction site at the state capitol building, climbing the scaffolding, and stealing flags off the roof. Capitol building security circulated security videos and video stills of the three men yesterday. In an email to legislative staffers, the Capitol's chief of security, Steve Daigle, said the heist went down around 1 a.m. on Friday. The Legislative Affairs Agency typically keeps a security guard on site around the clock. Daigle said he was forbidden from speaking to media. His boss, Legislative Affairs Agency Executive Director Pam Varney, could not be reached for comment. Construction of another British Columbia mine near a river that flows into Alaska could begin within a month, but it's a small operation sparking fewer concerns on this side of the border than some other projects. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld explains.
Brucejack is a high-altitude gold-and-silver prospect about 80 miles east of Wrangell. It's within the watershed of the Unic River, which drains into the ocean northeast of Ketchikan. Vancouver-based Pretium Resources is its owner and developer. Spokeswoman Michelle Romero says heavy equipment could begin moving by the end of August.
The construction would involve bulk earthworks first to level the area for the project infrastructure, the site facilities, as well as continuing the underground development in order to access the ore.
Brucejack is moving ahead because it just won a major environmental permit from Canada's federal government. British Columbia's Environmental and Mines Agencies okayed the project in March. Canadian officials found the mine would cause some adverse but not significant environmental impacts on fisheries, wildlife, and migratory birds. It also decided project plans meet terms of agreements with the Nisga First Nation, whose tribal members hunt and fish in the area. The Nisga were part of the environmental assessment process that led to the government's approval. Members will likely be among the hundreds of people hired to build and operate the mine.
We will be expected to hire from the north pursuant to all of our conditions, which includes everyone in the north in the communities that were part of our assessment.
Construction will take 2 years and cost about $750 million. Additional investments and a few more permits are still needed. Most transboundary mine concerns focus on safe storage of tailings, which are waste rock left over from the milling process. Romero says Brucejack will not store its tailings behind an earthen dam, which critics say is unsafe.
The tailings management plan is to put half of the tailings underground as part of the paste backfill in the spent mine workings, and then half would be deposited at the bottom of Brucejack Lake.
The high-altitude lake is frozen most of the year, has no fish, and rarely drains water. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A protest in Wrangell on Sunday marked the one-year anniversary of a mining disaster in Canada and sought to bring attention to mines being developed across the border from Southeast Alaska. KSDK's Katerina Sestarek reports.
About 100 people marched through Wrangell behind a banner that read, "Keep the Stikeen Clean." They marked the one-year anniversary of a British Columbia mine disaster with a rally and water blessing to raise awareness for other BC mines that could pose a threat to Southeast Alaska's rivers and salmon. Wrangell tribal member April Hutchinson said she hopes the community effort will make a difference.
We don't want what happened at Mount Polly to happen on the Stikeen. And we just want to make everybody aware, especially here in Wrangell, at the mouth of the river, aware that we are here and we're not going to stand for it.
A lot of the perception is that since it's going on in Canada, that we don't have much of a voice down here. And I think that's what this is about, is trying to get people motivated and involved and showing them that we do have a voice in this.
That's Mike Hoyt, who helped organize the event, along with Salmon Beyond Borders and the Wrangell Cooperative Association, the local tribal government. Last August, the Mount Polly mine in central BC spilled millions of gallons of mine waste into a salmon-bearing watershed. The owner of Mount Polly, Imperial Metals, also owns the Red Chris mine that opened this summer upriver from Wrangell. Red Chris has the same waste rock storage system that failed at Mount Polly. Clinkett and Haida tribal members, other Wrangell residents, conservation organizations, and representatives of First Nations in Canada marched to the Chief Sheikh's tribal house to sing, dance, and learn about BC mine issues. There was a strong call for unity between Native tribes of Alaska and First Nations of BC in efforts to prevent another mine disaster. Jacinda Mack is from the First Nation in the vicinity of the Mount Polly spill. She told the crowd this was the first year the community didn't have fish, and she's very worried about potential long-term effects on the environment.
My hope is that we can, my people from the Tsleil-Waututh, where the Mount Polly mining disaster happened, can work together with the different tribes of Alaska, because we have so much in common and so much to learn from each other and share with each other, and, you know, to protect our common interests of healthy, clean water.
Mac said she wants to help protect Alaska from the same problems. Oscar Dennis of the Tahltan Nation near the Red Chris mine talked about his direct action campaigns to expel other resource extractors from that area over the past 10 years. He said the rally was a start, but getting the U.S. and Canada to invoke the Boundary Waters Treaty could take some extra pressure. The treaty is intended to settle disputes about bodies of water shared by the two countries.
Letter writing's not going to get it done. And you know, you could sit here for 10 years and watch it, and by the time everything's over and destroyed, then, you know, you wake up, that's a little bit too late. You know, you have to force your politicians to take action. That's basically the only way. I mean, my experience after 10 years on the ground, it's the only way we've ever gotten results.
But Wrangell Tribal Administrator Aaron Angerman said it's important for everyone to get educated about what could happen.
And if Wrangell could wrap their heads around not having fish for a whole year, possibly longer, maybe really open their eyes to see what could happen with this mine up there, the Stikeen.
He plans to host more events like this in Wrangell, and he hopes more Southeast communities will follow suit. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katerina Sestarek.
Small hydroelectric projects proposed for the Cantwell area are receiving a mixed response. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the proposals outlined at a public meeting last week include both dam and river diversion projects.
The meeting was organized by the Denali Citizens Council to answer questions and gather feedback on the hydro projects being studied by the Native Village of Cantwell. Village Vice President Gordon Carlson is leading investigation of three proposed area projects.
We're looking at Carlo Creek, we're looking at Brush of Casna, we're looking at Jack River. The Jack River is more of a dam type, where it would have a reservoir backing up a little bit of water for some head pressure. The other two are basically diverting a little part of the stream into a pipe or a penstock where the pipe runs down, builds a little pressure, and turns like a Pelton wheel.
Carlson says the projects are all aimed at tapping renewable energy to lower power costs and raise revenue for the village, as well as create jobs. If built, the three projects are only projected to yield a tiny fraction of what the state's proposed Susitna-Watonna Dam would. Denali Citizens Council board member Nancy Bale says the meeting raised some concerns
about the viability of the smaller projects and the impacts to tourism. There was one fellow that boats on the Brush Casna, and he said he'd hate to see the water taken out of it. So I think the tourism and residential impacts with the Carlo and Brush Casna projects, people were pretty concerned about the impacts being big and the benefits being pretty small.
Bale also points to potential effects on grayling habitat. The primary source of locally generated electricity in the Cantwell-Denali area is from two coal-fired power plants operated by Golden Valley Electric Association in Healy. The utility also runs a nearby wind farm, and Bale says residents are receptive to more emission-free energy.
I think local people accepted the concept that renewables are better and that the benefit from the larger project could be discussed, but that the smaller projects were pretty negligible.
Bale and Carlson stress that the hydro projects are in a very preliminary stage, and Carlson urges people to give them a chance.
We don't know what the impact may or may not be. Is it even possible? So, I mean, I think people are getting upset, or the ones that are opposed to it are kind of premature without knowing what's going on.
The native village of Cantwell is working with Wasilla-based Northwest Power, which has experience with small-scale hydro in the lower 48. The two entities are in the first year of a three-year Federal Energy Regulatory Commission preliminary permit to study the projects. The study is primarily based on existing information with minimal field work. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Jeremy Shea and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Katerina Sestarik in Wrangell, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.